Now we're holding on page Tess in Yerushalmi Shkolim, Ois Chof Vov. So we learned last time that the Mishnah had mentioned that when you have 13 different places, you're supposed to bow down as you go around the Beis Hamikdash complex. So Rabbi Gamliel's and Rabbi Chanina Sgan HaKohanim's family would bow a 14th time by the Lishkas Dir HaEitzin, by the chamber where they kept the wood, because they had a Masoda in their families that's where the Oren was hidden at the end of the first Beis Hamikdash. So now the Gemara talks about the different opinions on that topic. What happened to the Oren at the time? What happened to the Oren before or at the time of the Churban? We learned about it in Bavli Yuma as well a while back. So the Yerushalmi says, Toni b'shem Rabbi Eliezer. We learn a Braisa in the name of Rabbi Eliezer. Oren goli mohem lebavel, that he says the Oren was not hidden underground, but rather it was taken with the Jewish people in Golos to Bavel. Actually, when we learned it in Yuma, there were actually Mephoshim there who wanted to say that maybe he doesn't disagree that it was hidden underground, but he would say that the Bavliim nevertheless were able to find it and bring it up from there and take it into Golos. Matam, where does Rabbi Eliezer get that from? Mishum Shanema, because you have 100 years earlier, you have the story in Sefer Melachim and also repeated in Yeshaya and more briefly in Divrei Hayamim, where after you had the Nisim that happened to Chizkiyahu, you had Sancheiriv's army was destroyed, so Chizkiyahu himself was deathly ill, and Hashem was healed in Mederach Nes and moved the sun backwards, etc., etc. So then messengers from the king of Babel at that time, Merodach Baladan, came to visit him because Merodach Baladan was very impressed by all of this, and Chizkiyahu showed them all his treasures and made it seem as though it was all his doing, as though it was all his schus, which then Yeshaya comes to him with a very sharply worded nevuah, very harsh nevuah, saying that what's going to happen because of that, eventually all of these treasures are going to be taken by the king of Babel and by a future king of Babel, and even your own descendants, including Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah, are going to be taken to serve in the king's palace over there. The expression that Yeshaya, by the way, the Malbim points out over there on Psukim, it is Midah Keneged Midah, but it's also, he says, it's a kind of a practical matter also. Until then, the kings of Babel had no idea how much wealth there is in Eretz Yisrael. Now all of a sudden they discovered it. It's like they filed that information away to know for the future, and that's what made them, and that's what gave them the idea to go and try to get it in the first place. Anyway, so the pasuk says, "Lo yuvasu dover oman Hashem." Hashem says, "All of these treasures are going to be taken. There won't be anything left," says Hashem. So now, on the surface, the pasuk is talking about all of Chizkiyahu's treasures. But since the pasuk already says, "Kol Hashem beisecha v'asher otzra beisecha," the earlier part of the pasuk is everything that's in your palace and everything that your ancestors stored up. So that means all the royal treasures. So we have to understand that the Yuvasa Dover is referring to something beyond that. Specifically, that in Dover Elashad Dibris v'Sochay. The word Dover then refers to the Oren in which the Dibris, in which the Luchas with the Aseres HaDibris are located. V'chein hu Omer. And Rabbi Eliezer continues. You see also from the Pesukim in Divrei Hayamim about what happened at the time of the Churban. V'l'shuvas Hashana, the Pesuk describes at the turn of the year, this is talking about after Yehoyakim had been killed or died, whatever, there are different opinions of what happened to him exactly. In any case, his son Yechonya was appointed as king after him. We're actually going to learn a little bit about that story when we get to Yerushalmi Tainis. So shortly after that, Nebuchadnezzar came back. He sent his general Nebuchadnezzar by Yehu Bavela, and he brought Yehoyachin to Bavel in clay chemdas beis Hashem, together with the desirable kalim of the house of Hashem. So ezo clay chemdas beis Hashem. What does that mean? Clay chemdas zeha oren. So Rabbi Eliezer says that refers to the oren. So we see that the oren was taken to Bavel. We actually find, first of all, as far as Chizkiyahu, the Medrash mentions that actually when Chizkiyahu showed him all the treasures in his palace and in the Beis Hamikdash and all, to the messengers of Merodach Baladan, he even had the Oren opened up and showed them the Luchas. And showed them, as the Gemara is going to go on to say, that this is what goes with us to battle. The Oren goes with us to battle, and that's how we win. So therefore, now the Eibishter is saying, as a result of that, that same Oren, says Rabbi Eliezer, that's how he understands the Pesukim, is going to be taken to Bavel. As far as calling it Klei Chemdas Beis Hashem, an interesting other example of that is you find a couple of hundred years before Chizkiyahu, you find Achav, who was a total Rosha, but nevertheless, you find at one point Ben-Hadad, the king of Aram, who was fighting against him, tells him at one point, everything you have to agree that I will say, I'm going to send my soldiers, and they're going to search through your entire palace and take whatever they want, because you're weak and you can't fight against me, and therefore you're going to have to live with that. And I'm even going to take Ben-Hadad uses the expression that I'm going to take your most precious things, called machma deinecha. And the Gemara explains in Sanhedrin that actually refers to the king's sacred Torah. And at that, Achav put his foot down. He talked it over with the Zekenim and put his foot down and said, Ben-Hadad, I'm willing to give away anything else, but not my kingly sacred Torah. So we see that that's called Machma Deinecha. And so it's the same word over here as Chemdas Beis Hashem, the same Shodash. So that's one opinion. On the other hand, Tani Rav Yehuda Bar Iloi, Rav Shimon Lakishomer, V'mekoymoi Hoya Ha'orun Gonuz. Note, the Orin was hidden underneath where it's supposed to be, meaning under the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Shenemar, the Pasuk says, V'yarichu Abadim Gomer, the poles of the Orin were extended, and the Pasuk describes, as we've learned before, how they were pushing out against the Poreches. You had, in the first place, Mikdash, there was a wall between the Kurdish and the Kurdish HaKadoshim, but then there was a doorway in the middle of that wall, and that doorway was covered with a Poreches, and so can describe how the Badim pushed out against it, so that you could see from the outside, when you were standing in the Heichel, you would see two bumps in a couple of other places. The Gemara compares it to the woman's breasts under her shirt, and the point of Ben Shaddai Yolin, Hashem would dwell over there, his Shekhinah would dwell over there between the two Badim, as if, so to speak, like a husband and wife being intimate. The point is that the Pasuk says that the poles were extended by Yerusham Ad HaYom Hazeh, and they were there until this very day. And the Gemara explains it, the Bavli explains in Yoma, when it says Ad HaYom Hazeh, means literally until this very day. It means anytime you read the Pasuk, it's going to say Ad HaYom Hazeh. So therefore, it must mean that the Oren is still there, and where would it be then? Under the Kurdish HaKadoshim. So HaKosef points out Rabbi Eliezer is not bothered by that, because he would say, fine, what the Pasuk means is the poles of the Aron are still just as long as they were when they brought it into the Kodesh HaKadoshim, but it doesn't mean that it's still located in the same place. Okay, so you have three different opinions, in short, what happened to the Aron. It was hidden under the Kodesh HaKadoshim, it was hidden under the Lishkas Dira Eitzim, or it was taken to Bava. Now, how many Aronis were there? So, Tony Rav Yehuda Ben Iloi, Beis Aronis Hoyu Yisrael by Midbar. The Jewish people had with them two Aronis in the desert. Echad Shahoisa Torah Nesuna B'Seichai. There was one that the Torah, which may mean a Sefer Torah, or it may mean the Luchos, which contain the whole Torah in capsule form. Hoya Nosun V'Oyel Moed. That one was placed in the Oyel Moed. That was the one that had the whole Luchos in it. Shenemar, as the Pasuk says, you find by the Machpelim after the Chet Meraglim, when Moshe tells them, this generation, you guys are not going into Eretz Yisrael, only your children were. So afterwards, you have everybody was very sad, and everybody did tshuva at that point, as the Alter Rebbe explains in Tanya and Perek Chof Tes. Moshe had yelled against their Yetzirah to the point where now the Yetzirah is broken, and now they have their Amunah and the Eibishter after all, and they say, let's go and try to conquer Eretz Yisrael. And Moshe tells them, now it's too late, it's not going to work. And they tried anyway, and the Pasuk says, V'aroin b'ris Hashem u'Moshe lo'y moshu mikerav ha'machne. The Oron and Moshe did not leave the Machne. And they went and they were defeated. So the implication is, in other words, that there would be an Oron that normally would go with them. Now, though, the way Rabbi Yehuda Ben Iloi is saying it is that this is actually not the one that would regularly go with them. He's going to go on to say that only the one with the broken luchos would go with them. So what's the proof from this? And in fact, there are Mephoshim who say that maybe you should take out that proof from the Pasuk, because what kind of proof is that? The fact is, the Oren that stays in the Machna, the one that we're talking about over here, that has the whole Luchos, wasn't going to go out with them to war anyway. On the other hand, there are Mephoshim who defend it, and they say that the idea would be, in other words, they should have realized, no Oren is going with us, how are we going to be successful? So that shows that at least there is an Oren that's going with them, even if it's not this particular one. Anyway, V'hasheni shoyishivri Luchos nesunin v'soichai, then there was the second one, that the broken luchos were placed in it, hayim nichnes v'yotze imahem. That one would go in and out with them to war, pa'omim hayim misra'a imahem b'mochama, and sometimes it would be seen with them in the war. Now, again, there are different gersois over here, whether those words belong over here. If we're saying it went with them to war, of course it's seen with them in war. Why would it even need to say that? So a number of Mephoshim take out the line, but then there are others that defend it and say that, no, what it means is, in other words, when they went to war, sometimes they would actually have it near the soldiers, and sometimes they would have it behind the lines.
So therefore, sometimes you could actually see it. The soldiers are going to war, and you would see that the Ordon is being carried with them, and sometimes it would be someplace there in the Machne, but not right there visible with the soldiers.
Where it says that he took it with him.
So we're going to talk about those psukim. We're going to talk about those psukim now in the Gemara. But now, one thing is, this whole thing that the Yerushalmi is saying over here, that there were two Aronis, is not universally agreed to. The Bavli, when it talks about the Aron in Bava Basra, instead says that the Luchas and the Shivrei Luchas were all in one Aron.
How did it fit?
So because the Gemara explains over there, so first of all, you have different opinions how big the luchas were anyway. The Bavli says that the luchas were 6 tefachim by 6 tefachim, the faces of them, and then the thickness was 3 tefachim. The Yerushalmi elsewhere seems to say, or at least it can be understood as saying, that each one was actually 6 by 3 by 3. An interesting point in that regard is like this. You have the luchos. We know that Eber made a big point about the luchos have to be drawn not with rounded tops as they sometimes do in the Velt, but you find some Lubavitcher publications like Talks and Tales, for example, that have them drawn square, and then you have other ones that have them drawn rectangular. And very often on our very own parochas over here, we have them drawn rectangular. Those, fine, because those can reflect the different opinions of the Bavli versus the Yerushalmi, whether they were fronts of them were square or rectangular. In any case, according to the Bavli, it comes out that what you would have is you would have the broken luchas, and then on top of them, you would have the whole luchas. Given that the luchas were only 3 tefachim thick, so there would be room for 3 tefachim plus another 3 tefachim on top. Fine, the height of the Oren, you have different opinions, whether the Oren is measured, whether the amos of the Oren are 5 or 6 tefachim, but even according to Yehuda, that the amos of the Oren, the amma and a half height of the Oren, is 7.5 tefachim, that still gives you plenty of room for 6 tefachim for the whole luchas and the broken luchas. According to the Yerushalmi, it may actually be that the whole luchas. Well, you see, the Yerushalmi over here was saying, at least according to Rabbi Yehuda ben Eloi, that which is Stam Rabbi Yehuda in Shas, that according to him, you have the whole luchas and the broken luchas were in different aronis. But it might also be, given what the Yerushalmi says as far as the size of them, if we understand it to be saying they were 6 by 3, they might have been placed one next to the other. So you have the broken luchas and then next to them the whole luchas, and you wouldn't need and you would rather than having one on top of the other.
There's an opinion that there was also a Madaf.
There's also an opinion in the Gemara in the Bavli that the Yerushalmi also mentions the whole thing over here about that there was a shelf outside it for the Sefer Torah. Right, that has to do with the opinion. According to the Yehuda, there's no room inside the Oren for the Sefer Torah next to the Luchos, because according to him, the whole length of the Oren is only 12.5 tefachim, and 12 tefachim are taken up by the Luchos. So yeah, according to him, the Sefer Torah was on the outside on a shelf, and then afterwards on top of the box of golden ornaments that the Plishkin gave after they captured the Oren. Yeah, and then the Gemara discusses that whole point in Bava Basra, the Bavli discusses in Bava Basra, yeah. Anyway, the point is, this idea over here that we're saying that there were two Aronis, and according to that, one of them was made by Moshe, so we have in Parashat Ekev, where Hashem tells him, V'asisa l'cha Aron Eitz, and another one, the other one that was made by Bezalel, according to the Yerushalmi over here, there were two different Aronis, whereas according to the Bavli, there was only the one Aron. So in other words, there would be the one that Moshe temporarily made to hold the Luchas until the Mishkan was built, and afterwards that was replaced by Bezalel's Aron, and according to that, Moshe's Aron was never used again. So our Gemara is going according to is following the opinion that they still continued to have two Aronis. So that's the Gemara continues. But Rabbanan Amri, now the Chachamim disagree with Rabbi Yehuda ber Eloi. They say, Oren Echad Hoya, there was in fact only the one Oren. Pam Achas, and it never usually went with them to war. Pam Achas, Yotzi b'nei Eli, only one time did they take it out to war in the times of Eli, where in Sefer Shmuel it describes how at one point they went to fight against the Plishtim, and they suffered the Jewish people suffered a defeat on the first day of battle, and they decided, let's bring the Oren with us, that way Hashem the Schus will save us. And it was captured by the Venishva, and it was captured by the Plishtim. So the Gemara points out, Messiah Krol Rabbanan. Now we have one of the Psukim in that connection seems to support the opinion of the Chachamim that there was in fact only one Oren, and that it wasn't a usual thing for the Oren to be brought out to battle. Because you have the Plishtim, when they find out, the Psukim describe, when they brought the Oren to the camp, to the Jewish camp, everybody was shouting for joy because they figured now for sure we're going to win. And the Psukim describe, the Plishtim heard all the shouting and they started asking and trying to investigate what's going on. And then they found out that the Oren has been brought. And the Pasuk says, they were saying to themselves, Oy lonu, woe to us. Mi yatzivenu miyad ho elekim ha'adirim ha'ela. Who is going to save us from this mighty God? So like all of a sudden, what do you mean, Oilonu? And they had been Oren had never been there before. So Milaya, Delechomen Miamehen, because this is something they'd never seen. Now they had fought against the Jewish people many times before. The day before that, they had fought against them. But this is a chiddush that there should be the Oren over there. So therefore, so that supports the Chachamim's opinion that there's only the one Oren, and then this time was the first time that it was ever brought out to war. On the other hand, you also have a pasuk that supports Rabbi Yehuda Rabbi Loi's opinion, because later on in Sefer Shmuel, you have yet another battle against the Plishtim, and in the course of the battle, at one point, Shaul wants to ask the Urim and Tumim what to do, because you have a whole thing over there where the Plishtim are all thrown into confusion because Yehonasan and his arms bearer had gone in the and then by themselves and gone and started killing Plishtim in a very brave way, and now the Plishtim are all thrown into confusion, and Shaul sees it from the other side of the valley and is wondering what to do. So Vayomer Shmuel Achia, so Shmuel says to Achia, who was the Kohen Gadol at the time, Hagisha Aron HaLekim, bring close the Oren, because the Kohen, where is the Urim B'Tumim, and is being asked for them, stands in front of the Oren. So what do you mean, bring the Oren, as if to imply it's already here, and all you need to do is bring it closer? V'aloya Oren B'kiryas Yorim Ha'ava V'chola. By that point, the Oren, so after the Plishtim had captured the Oren, and they'd suffered terrible plagues and everything for it, and they were finally forced to return it, it was brought to the city of Beis Shemesh, and the Jewish people there, the Jews in there in Beis Shemesh, didn't know how to treat it with respect, and a terrible plague broke out. So they asked the people of Kiryas Yorim, a nearby town, to take the Oren and keep it by them. It remained by them for 20 years until David brought it to Yerushalayim. So at this point, during Shaul's reign, it's located in Kiryas Yorim, and the battle was taking place. Kiryas Yorim is at the edge of Binyamin's territory. The battle was taking place in the city of Michmash, which is further east of Binyamin's territory, so they're nowhere near each other. They were a good few miles apart. So we may have Gisha Oren HaLekim. That suggests that the Oren was, in fact, already in the Machne, and all they have to do is bring it close to where Achia and Shaul are standing. So that supports Rabbi Yehuda's opinion that there was, in fact, an Oren that would regularly go with them to battle. There are, in fact, Mephoshim who kind of try to combine the two opinions and say that, I think Rashi mentions it in one place, that what it is with following Rabbi Yehuda's opinion, they usually would bring the Oren with the broken luchas to battle, like Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Loi says. They would never bring out the gold-plated Oren that Bezalel made that had the whole luchas in it. The one time in the battle of Perek Dalet, they brought the one with the whole luchas in it, and that ended up being captured by the Plishtim, and everything developed from there. Okay. The Gemara continues, Mishin Nignaz Oren, once the Oren was hidden away, Nignaz Imot Sinsenes HaMon, then also the jar of Mon that was kept, we know that in Parshas B'Shalach, Hashem tells Moshe, fill up a jar with Mon and keep it L'mishmeres L'dere Seichem, as something as a keepsake for all time, that everybody should be able to see the bread that the Jewish people, the food that the Jewish people ate in the Midbar. Rashi brings over there on the Pasuk, based on a Medrash, that in particular in the times of Yirmiyah, there were Jewish people who were wondering, how can we possibly, you're telling us we should be learning Torah full time, how are we going to make a living? And so Hashem tells Yirmiyah, go show them that jar of mon and show them they were able to in the midbar, and Hashem provided for them, and Hashem can do the same thing for you. So
open up the jar, was it translucent?
So there's different opinions about that. There's one, some Mephoshim learn that the jar was made out of earthenware, and in that case, yeah, he would have had to open it up. Others learn that it was made out of glass, and in that case, he could have showed them without opening it. Yeah. Either way, of course, that was a nest in itself, because usually, as we know, the mon would spoil or become wormy after a day, and here it remained fresh for hundreds of years. Anyway, so that was placed in front of the Oren. Hashem tells Moshe to tell Aaron to place it in front of the Oren, the Mishmeres, the Deres Seichem. So now, when the Oren was hidden away, then also this jar of mon was hidden with it, with Sloiches Shemen HaMishcha, as well as the jar of Shemen HaMishcha, the flask of Shemen HaMishcha. So from then on, by the way, that had implications in Halacha. From then on, they couldn't anoint like this. Until then, the Kohenim Golem was supposed to be anointed with the Shemen HaMishcha, and also kings, if there was a machloikus about who's going to be the next king. From now on, they couldn't do that. From now on, the Kohenim Golem are instead Merubah Begodim. They became Kohenim Golem by wearing the eight clothes of the Kohen Gadol and doing the Avodah. Which means, in particular, you have one difference between them. The Mishnah tells us in the Sechta Megillah, one difference between them is that when it describes in Parshas Vayikra, how you have a special korban that the Kohen Gadol brings if he makes a mistake in Halacha and follows it. It was in Shlosha Prakim of Rambam last week. Then that's only done by a Kohen who was anointed with the Shemen HaMishcha, not Merubah Begodim. So therefore, in the end of the first Beis Mikdash, in the entire second Beis Mikdash, that korban wouldn't be able to be brought anymore. Anyway, so that's the Shemana Mishkan. Umakle shel Aaron prochel shkigah. Another thing that was hidden away with the Aaron is Aaron's staff with the flowers and the almonds on it. We have in Parshas Korach where Hashem tells Moshe to take staffs from all the Nesim and put them in front of the Aaron. And v'hoyo ish asherif chabeh mateu yifrach. And Aaron's staff is the one that blossomed and produced almonds, and that showed once and for all that Shevet Levi and specifically Aaron are the ones chosen specially by Hashem for the avoda. So that was also in front of the Aaron.
So that the blood for hundreds of
years. So it remained, the flowers and the almonds remained on it for hundreds of years, and again it was in front of the Aaron, and it was hidden away together with the Aaron. The Babli, by the way, learns that when it brings this in Yuma, it brings a bunch of Zera Shavas, how we know that each of these things had to be in front of the Aaron, and how we know that each of them was hidden away with the Aaron, because by someone it says Mishmeres, and it says Lododa Seichem, and we have a series of Zera Shavas that teach us about all of them. And another thing, the Augas Sheshi replished him Oshem Leleke Yisrael, and also at that time, back at the time, again, before even Shaul became king, when Shiloh was destroyed and the Plishtim captured the Aron, and then they suffered all kinds of terrible plagues, and they were forced to return the Aron after 7 months. So the Psukim described, they asked their priests and their magicians and whatnot, people who have a certain connection with Ruchnius, at least to their way of thinking, what should we do as far as returning the Aron? And they told them, don't just return the Aron like that, also give a gift to the Jewish God, and that way you'll show that you're sorry for what you did, and Hashem will take away away these plagues. So the Psukim describe how they fashion a bunch of golden images of mice, because that was one of the things that had been ravaging the land, and a bunch of images of golden swellings of various types that they had also suffered on their bodies. And they placed those all in a box and sent it together on the wagon with the Aron, and from then on that box was kept next to the Aron. As you mentioned before, the Gemara, the Bavli and Baba Basra mentions that according to Rabbi Yehuda, that the Sefer Torah that Moshe wrote wouldn't fit inside the Aron, then there was a shelf outside the Aron. They would put it on. After that, there was this box over there and they placed it on top of the box. You're wondering, you know, you're making a face, like, why would that box belong next to the Aron? I guess one... It's not about a Zorah per se, because they didn't make them for worship. They made them as a gift to Hashem. But I guess one thing you could think of is that, really, when you think about it, that's the first time in history that an entire Goyish nation showed respect to Hashem. The Mitzrayim, for example, didn't. They gave the Jewish, they lent, quote-unquote, the Jewish people gold and silver and whatnot before they left, but they didn't actually do anything to show that they respect Hashem's power. All the nations that fought against the Jewish people and were defeated over and over during the time of the Shoftim, we never find that. Here we find the Plishtim for the first time are doing that, so maybe that's something special that deserves to be in the Kodesh HaKadosh.
Also, maybe Nimbei Buchena.
That was later. That was later anyway, but yeah. Besides, there's nothing tangible that you can put in there. Okay, anyway. So fine. So all of those things were hidden together with the Aron. Mi Gonzoi, who is it that hid away the Aron? So again, according to Rabbi Eliezer before, who said that the Aron was captured and taken to Babel, then obviously this whole thing doesn't begin. But according to the other opinions that we said that was hidden under the Kodesh HaKadoshim, under the Lishkas Dira Eitzim, who is it that hid it? And the answer is Yoshiyahu, who was one of the last kings of Yehuda. He became king at 8 years old, and he ruled for 31 years, and he was killed in battle by Paro Nechoi 22 years before the Churban. So what happened? In the 18th year of his reign, so he was 26 years old, this is 36 years before the Churban, he gave orders that the Beis Mikdash should be renovated, that by that time it had been about 200 odd years since the last big renovation of the Beis Mikdash. It was badly in need of repair. So when they were doing the renovations, then they found a Sefer Torah, and there's different opinions what was so special about the Sefer Torah. The Pasuk describes everybody was very taken aback by it. They brought it to Yoshiyahu, and Yoshiyahu was also very impressed by it, and decided we have to make a massive Tshuva movement in the whole Eretz Yisrael. There's different opinions among Mefarshim what was so special about that Sefer Torah. Some say that Bechlal, they may not have seen very many Sifrei Torah. Menashe and Amon, the two kings before Yoshiyahu, had destroyed as many Sifrei Torah as they could get their hands on, so it's very possible that at least Yoshiyahu himself had grown up never seeing a Sefer Torah. Others say, it's very hard to say that. The fact is, we Jewish people have always learned and kept the Torah. You always had a core of faithful Jews who kept the Torah. So they give different explanations. Another possibility is that it was the original Sefer Torah that Moshe Rabbeinu had written. So in that case, that's something special. Another possibility is that it may have been Taka, a regular Sefer Torah, but in particular, as the Gemara is going to say over here, it was rolled to a particular place in the Teuchacha, and therefore that's Simona Milsa. The very fact that they found an open rolled to that place is something unusual. Usually, by the way, the Bavli in Bava Basra describes the Sefer Torah that was kept in or next to the Oren was usually rolled near the beginning. The Gemara describes over there, there wouldn't have been room to roll it all the way. It had only one eighth chayim, unlike our Sefer Torah have two. But it wouldn't have been rolled all the way to the beginning of Bereshit, because then there wouldn't have been room for it in the Aron. The Gemara calculates, so it was rolled to like Parshas Noach or something. It was rolled like a little bit further in from the beginning, so that there would be enough room for it in the Aron. The point is, here he found it, instead rolled to Parshas Yisrael. Anyway. So what happened? Kivin Shirah, Shakasa Boy, when he saw that in the Sefer Torah that was written, the Pasuk Yolach Hashem Oischa Bes Malkacha Shetokha Malacha, in the Torah in Parshat Savai, Hashem is going to take you and your king that you set up over yourselves into Golos. So he realized that means there's a Simon Min HaShemayim that the Golos is coming very soon. And he didn't want that the Oren should fall into the hands of the Goyim. Omad V'gonzai. So therefore he went ahead and had it hidden away. Kenema, as we find Psukim in Divrei Hayomim, by Yomer LaLevim Amavinim L'Cho Yisrael, he said to the Levim who understand Torah among all the Jewish people, like the ones especially among the Jewish people who understand the Torah best, Hakdoshim LaHashem, who, being Levim, are holy to Hashem, he tells them, Tnu es Aron HaKodesh Ba'bayis HaShabona Shlomo Ben David Melech Yisrael. Place the Aron HaKodesh in the house that Shlomo Ben David Melech Yisrael built. Now, what do you mean place the Aron in the house? It had been there already for 400 years. So there are Mephoshim who say on a Pashtus level that maybe, for example, when Menashe put an idol in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, maybe he took out the Aron, so now Yoshio has to tell them to put it back, but the Gemara doesn't like that explanation, and it's understanding that he's telling them to put it in the underground vault that Shlomo had built all those years before. He continues telling them, Ein lachem masa b'kosef, you no longer after this have the mitzvah of carrying the kelim of the Beis HaMikdash on your shoulders, as you did back in the Midbar. After Yivdu as Hashem b'gam, and now you're going to serve Hashem and the Jewish people by hiding away the Aron. Meaning, what's this Ein lachem masa b'kosef? Omer lahem, because Yeshayahu is telling them, Im goyle imachem lebavo, you should know, if the Aron goes with you and golos lebavo, shuvah in echoz lemekomei, it's never going to return to its place. So therefore, we don't want that. Therefore, we have to hide it away here in the Beis HaMikdash, underneath the Beis HaMikdash. What does that mean? Why is it not going to return? Various Mephoshim talk about a few different possibilities. First of all, it could mean that the Goyim would never allow them to return it. As it is, you have, finally, when Kodesh proclaimed that they can build the second Beis HaMikdash, and later on, when Daryavish reconfirmed that permission 18 years later, they allowed them to take back the Kalim of the Beis HaMikdash, but had the Aron been there, they never would have allowed that to go. So that's one point. Another point would be that you might not be, the Jewish people might not be on the level at that point to be on the level of Kedusha, to be able to carry the Aron anymore. After all, we find that people who were unsuitable, who touched the Aron, died, like Uzzah, for example. And a third possibility is maybe the mitzvah of carrying it won't apply anymore. And a fourth possibility is maybe the Aron will lose its Kedusha if it leaves Eretz Yisrael and goes to Babel. So whatever, for any or all of those reasons, Yeshayahu is telling them, the Aron can't go to Babel, and therefore we don't want it to fall into the hands of whichever army it's going to be. That, as the Pasuk says, Yoylech Hashem Oischa, therefore we have to hide it away under the Beis HaMikdash. Since we mentioned as I mentioned the other day, the Rebbe talks about Nesicha, that the Rambam brings this point, and the Rambam learns that it was in fact hidden under the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and the point of that Lahalocha, the Rambam doesn't bring things in Mishnah Torah that are not in Yad HaZaka, that are not needed Lahalocha, the point is that establishes, therefore, that the second Beis HaMikdash is still considered to have the Kedusha of a Beis HaMikdash, insofar as, for example, that you can bring Korbanos there, and that you can't bring Korbanos anyplace else, etc. All of that depends on the point of the Oren being still there in its location under the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and the Rebbe develops the idea in that Sicha that basically there's two places that are valid for the Aron, one in the Kodesh HaKadoshim and one underneath it.
According to the Girsa, that the Aron is not there.
According to the Girsa, the Aron is not there. He might say, in fact, that maybe the second Beis HaMikdash had to. Bechlau, you have a machloikus. What you have a machloikus between the Rambam and the Ramban, which also the Rebbe has Sichas on the subject. What is the basic function of the Beis HaMikdash? Is it basically a place to bring korbanos, or is it basically a place for the Shechina to rest? If you say it's basically a place to bring korbanos, then it doesn't matter so much whether the Aron is there or not. If you say that if it's mainly a place for Ashura HaShechina, then the Aron has to be there. So that would depend. Rabbi Eliezer, who says that the Oren was taken to Babel, he might well say, fine, but the Bais HaMikdash doesn't necessarily require the Oren to be there in order for it to have the definition of the Bais HaMikdash. In any case, when the third Bais HaMikdash is built, then the Oren will be back there in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. An interesting point, by the way, that Mefarshim deal with is why, for example, let's say the menorah we find was stolen by the Greeks when they took over the Bais HaMikdash, and then they made a new one after when the Hashmonaim took back over. Similarly, the other kelim were all replaced. Why don't they just make a new Oren for the second Bais HaMikdash? And there's a couple of answers. One of them being that, first of all, the Oren is not the Oren without the Luchos. So if they don't have the Luchos, then it doesn't really mean much anyway. But aside from that, there's the idea that the Oren itself has a special degree of Kedusha that couldn't be replicated afterwards. Besides, and also an interesting point is the Chlal. How did the when you have, so like this, any replacement, for example, let's say they replaced the menorah. Now, we said the Shemana Mishcha was hidden away. So how did they make that new menorah when the Hashminoi made a new menorah? How did it become a menorah that's valid lahalacha to be used in the Bais HaMikdash? So the Gemara explains in a couple of places that only the original kelim that were made in Moshe Rabbeinu's times had to be anointed with Shemana Mishcha. After that, Avodasim Nachanachton. After that, whenever you use a keli for the Avodah, it automatically becomes Kodesh by virtue of that. Well, that works for the menorah, for example. You light the menorah the first time, then it becomes kodesh. Same thing with any other keli in the Bais HaMikdash. The Oren, there's no avodah you do with it. All it is it contains the luchos. So there's no avodah that you could say avodasim machanachton, and that would also be a reason. Acharonim give these various reasons and others why there couldn't be an Oren, why there couldn't be a replacement Oren in the second Bais HaMikdash.
What about the
sprinkling with blood? That's done in front of the Oren, between the Badim or whatever. The Oren itself is not actually used for it. You know, yeah.
One does not negate
the other. Right. Okay. Speaking of the Shemana Mishka, the Gemara says, Tony Rabbi Yehuda Bar Eloi. Now, before this, the Gemara brings over here, and the Bavli also brings it in Hurrius and a couple of other places, about how was the Shemana Mishka made in the first place. So one opinion is that they're not certainly described. You have to take a bunch of various spices of different kinds, and then you take a shemen zayis hin, which is approximately a gallon of olive oil. So now the question is the idea is that you make it, the shemen amishah, you make it into perfumed oil using those spices. So first the Gemara brings an opinion. That they boiled the spices in, they ground up the spices and boiled them in the oil. But then the objection is that, what do you mean? The oil, that's not enough oil to even soak the spices, much less boil them. So in the end, so he gives a different explanation, and then the Gemara ends up saying, Tonin Rabbi Yehuda Bar Eloi, Shemana Mishka, so also Moshe Bamidbar, Maisin Nisim Hoyba Mitchilosev, Ad Soifo, really the whole thing was one big series of Nisim from beginning to end. The whole thing was only 12 lugin, which again is around a gallon or a little more. Shenam of a shemen zayis hin. A hin is 12 lugin. And im losuch vayse ikrim lohei maspik. It wouldn't even be enough to soak all of the spices. When you look at the amounts of spices that it says in the psukim, 500 shekels weight of this one and 250 of that one and so forth, it comes out, it's a much bigger volume even than this 12 lug of oil. So lohei maspik, it wouldn't be enough for that even. Alachas kamav kamor shal ur beleya. Now you have to think, you're boiling up the oil together with the spices. Necessarily, some of it would evaporate by the fire. But eitzim boilim, some of it would be absorbed by the spices themselves. The yoda boila and the vat that you're cooking it all up in would absorb some of it. And yet, not only it stayed the entire 12 lugin, omi menu nimshach mishkan v'chol kelav. With it, they were able to anoint the mishkan and all of its vessels. Va'koyinim b'malochim and the koyinim gdolim of future generations. And the kings, whenever David himself, and then any of his descendants were there, whenever there was a machlotus, as the Gemara goes on to discuss in detail. And the Gemara continues, and the whole 12 lugin, the Derech Nes, still continued to exist, and will continue to exist lo'olam vayed.
They're
always going to be 12 lugim, no matter how much of it they use. So this is all derech nes. So therefore, so don't worry about that there wasn't enough on the face of it. There's not enough oil to cook up the ikrin in. Don't worry, there wasn't enough oil to use up and still have 12 lugim left, and yet there's a nes. There's a sticha, I think, where the Rebbe talks about the underlying machlokas. Is it once we say it had to be mais and nisim, can we say everything was done mais and nisim, or does the Torah require that at least you do as much as possible with derech hateva, and whatever can't will be done with derech nes? But Amram, in fact, Paskins, according to the other opinion, and Amram Paskins, according to the opinion, I think it's Rabbi Yossi, who says what they did is they soaked the ikrim, they soaked all these spices in water until the water absorbed all of the aroma of the spices. Then they boiled up the oil together with the water, and then when the water evaporates, then you have left the essence of the spices in the oil. So that way, at least it doesn't require mice and nissen for that part. But yeah. Okay. Going back now to the luchos, Kates and Hoyu are luchos ksuvim. How were the Dibros written on the Luchos? So Rav Hananya ben Gamliel oimer chamisha al luach zeh v'chamisha al luach zeh. So Rav Hananya ben Gamliel says that there were five, exactly as we usually picture them, five written on one luach and five on the other. Shenema, as the Pasuk says, v'yichtevem ashnei luach zavonim, the Pasuk says he wrote them on two tablets of stone, implying if there's 10 Dibros and there's two tablets, hey al zeh v'hei al zeh, then it means there's five on each, the way that we usually see them depicted on Paroi Chassin and on other depictions like that. On the other hand, Rabbanan Amri Asora Aluach Zev Asora Aluach Zev. The Chum say all 10 of them were written on one, and then they were rewritten on the other one. Shenema Vayagid Lachemas Brisei Ashetziva Aschemlases Aseres Advarim. The pasuk says Hashem told you His bris, His covenant, which He commanded you to do the 10 dvarim. And when it says the 10 dvarim, implies that they're all and the pasuk continues by Yichtevim al Shnei Luchos Avanim. He wrote them on two stones. So this opinion of the Rabbanan holds that it means, in other words, all 10 had to be written on each of the two luchos, not 5 and 5, but 10 and 10. And we'll talk about afterwards once we go through this piece what would be the reasons for these different opinions. V'Reb Shimon Yechoy Omer Chof al Luach Zeh V'Chof al Luach Zeh. Rav Shimon Yochai says that there were 20 on one luach and 20 on the other, meaning that the Aseres HaDibros were written twice on each luach and then written again on the other one. Shenemer Vayichtevem al Shnei Luchos Avanim, as the pasuk says, he wrote them on the two tablets of stone. So since, in other words, since it says, now we know already that there were two luchos, So it means, just like Vayichtevein, it means that he wrote them on one stone, so on one tablet, the other one also means that since you have another pasuk that describes that he wrote them on two stone luchos, then it means it was written twice, and it means that it was with all 10 dibros were written twice on each one. What's the significance? We'll talk about it at the end.
So, how did he, say that it's quay because that's Vayichtevem, because it's a Loshen Rabbi?
Because it says Vayichtevem al Shnei Luchos, so why does it need to say Vayichtevem and al Shnei Luchos? So it's repetitious. Vayichtevem, could have said Vayichtoiv al Shnei Luchos, yeah. So that gives us a reason to say that it was written multiple times on each Dibros, on each Luach. Reb Simoy Omer Mem al Luach Zeh Mem al Luach Zeh. Reb Simoy says it was written 40 times, 40 Dibros on one Luach and 40 on the other. So on each Luach, it was written 8 times. Shenema Mizeh Umizeh Heim Ksuvim. As the pasuk says, they were written from this side and from that side, which elsewhere the Gemara explains means that the letters could be seen. They went all the way straight through, as the Gemara tells us, that the Babli tells us in Travis, the Yerushalmi tells us in Megillah, the letters penetrated all the way through from side to side, and Reb Simoy understands that to mean that they were actually not just, now the Babli, when it tells about it in Shabbos, explains that yes, the letters went all the way through, and Bederach Nes, they could be read forward on the other side, meaning in other words, you'd see, for example, an Aleph, it wouldn't be a backwards Aleph on the other side, it would be a straight Aleph. However, the Gemara says over there, the words themselves would read backwards on the other side. The Gemara gives an example of that. If you had the word, let's say, for example, if you had the word Nevuv, Nun Veiz, Vav Veiz, then reading on the other side, you would have Veiz, Vav Veiz, Nun. But our Reb Simoy over here in the Gemara is saying, at least according to one way of understanding him, that no, what it means is they were actually, you could read it, the Derech Nes, the proper direction, no matter which side you looked at. So not only it went all the way through, but the Derech Nes, it would actually read the right way.
Wasn't it only the first
luchos? We're talking primarily the first luchos. And by the way, one of the many opinions that explains why the Dibros had to be repeated, we'll talk about it soon, but one of the many opinions about it is, we know there are two versions of the Dibros, one in Yisrael and one in Vos Chanan. So one explanation is, in fact, that when we're saying over here that the Dibros were written multiple times, it would mean because they had to incorporate both versions. With that said, there are other Mephoshim who learn that the ones in Yisrael were written on the first Luchos and the ones in Vos Chanan were written on the second Luchos. But yeah, primarily we're talking about, I mean, by both sets of Luchos, it was Michtav Elikim Hu. So, So the pashtus, all the psukim that we're talking about over here, all the psukim that we're darshaning from, are in connection with the first luchas. So it's possible that they mean only these things by the first luchas, but given that they were michtav alekim hu by yichtav al luchas kamichtav arishon, then maybe it would also apply to the second luchas as well. The truth is, there is a lot of different. There is a lot of discussion. There's an interesting discussion also that Advaz, among others, brings an interesting point. The Gemara in Sanhedrin tells us that at one point the script that's used for writing Kisvei Kodesh, according to one opinion, was changed. They used to use what's called Ksav Ivri or Ksav Liberna. You find it, for example, on coins from the time of the second Beis Mikdash and inscriptions from the time of the first Beis Mikdash, and then you have Ksav Ashuri, the square letters that we're familiar with. So the Gemara brings an opinion in Sanhedrin that there was a period of time when they were writing in Ksav Ivri, and then in Ezra's time they changed to Ksav Ashuri. So there's an interesting idea, I think, that Advaz says that maybe the first luchos were written in Ksav Ivri, were written in Ksav Ashuri, and the second luchos, which were on a lower level, were written in Ksav Ivri. In other words, because at that point they're on a lower level after the Chet Egel.
But according to history, the Ksav Ivri is cursed.
Well, according to history, never mind. I mean, the fact is, according to that opinion, we would say that Ksav Ashuri was used only for Kisvei Kodesh, where we don't have any Kisvei Kodesh from that time, and then. So there's a lot.
With the sapphire? On the sapphire?
Yeah, it was written on the sapphire, yeah.
That's the most expensive stone, right?
Yes, yeah. So anyway, so again, sort of, Simoi says, Mema Luach Zeh, Mema Luach Zeh. 40 on each luach, shenema mizeh mizehim ksuvim, meaning, as he says, as the pasuk says, they were written from this side or the other, tetruga, which means that there were fourfold, there were tetruga, and in Greek, tetra means four, so tetruga would mean four times. So we'll continue tomorrow with it, that's the Shem, but there are a lot of different possibilities that you can see over here. Akosev himself has a diagram over here to illustrate what it means when he says that they were written two times on each luach, according to the Shem Ben Yochai. The old ten dibros were written twice on each luach. So you have, he learns that it was written one time right side up and the other one upside down. So in other words, whichever way you turn the luach, whether you hold it right side up or whether you turn it upside down, you'd have a set of dibros written in the proper direction. Then there are Mephoshim who learn that it means that according to him, they were written on both sides, and again, it was Bederach Nes that you can see through from side to side, and then the opinion that says, Reb Simoi, who says they were written 40 times, would say it was written actually on the sides as well, not only on the front and back, but also on the sides, so that you have 10 on each one, and then you have Bederach Nes, in other words, it was carved one time through, and Bederach Nes, it could be read straight through on all four sides. So we'll talk about tomorrow, about Hashem, the various opinions in that, and the significance of them. Okay. Yom Yom Mashiach Ge'ola, Yud Aleph Tishrei. So today is B'Shem Hashem, Gos Nomen. And now you have the pasuk that says about that Hashem is going to sprinkle us with Par Adroma water, as we said over and over in Yom Kippur Davening, was Zarakti Alechem Ayim Tehurim Tehartim, that Hashem himself will sprinkle us with pure water. So we see in that the greatness of the Jewish people. You have the Mishnah at the end of Yuma, Ashreichem Yisrael, before whom to become pure. Who is the one who purifies you? Avichem Shebashamayim. And then the Rebbe continues this Diuk Haloshon Lifnei Me'atim Metarim. The word Lifnei also means in front of, ahead of, like Lifnei Havaya Tetoru, which means like Chassidus, that we go to a level even higher than Shem Havaya on Yom Kippur. And then that Tara is even higher than that. In a similar vein, that's why it's explained that in Kesef Shem Tov, why the day after Yom Kippur is called Gotz Nomen, because Yom Kippur is already Lifnei Havaya, we're already higher than Shem Havaya, so therefore the day after that was in today's Hayom Yom as well, is only called Gotz Nomen, as if like you can't even say any specific name, because already we're beyond that. Some halachas of Sukkah. So when it comes to building the walls of a sukkah, one thing is they have to not move around in the wind. So one thing is when you have the canvas sukkahs where the walls do move in the wind, there's quite a bit of discussion among poskim whether such a thing is valid, given that basically they do stay in place and they just flap around a little bit or not. So one thing is one piece of advice they often give for that purpose is take ropes and tie them around between the poles of the sukkah within three tefachim of each other. Do a few rounds of that below, and that way you have at least 10 tefachim of height made up of those ropes with less than three tefachim between them. And that way it's lovered, and that way for sure you're covered, even if the rest of the wall all the way up is made out of canvas and flax. 10 tefachim is about 30 inches.
Okay.